This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As a nation, the United States has embraced the incarceration of people committing all kinds of crimes. 3 years ago, our incarceration rate was the highest in the world, and our record of prisoner treatment is also spotty. According to a Reuters News Service 2013 report, a Mississippi prison for severely mentally ill inmates was so badly run, they lived in barbaric conditions in filthy quarters without working lights or toilets. It was a place where prisoners sold rats to one another as pets. Most people go through life not thinking much about prisons until something happens inside one that brings attention to those facilities. In 1971, 1,300 prisoners at Attica State Correctional Facility in upstate New York took over that prison to protest for more humane living conditions in what was then an overcrowded penitentiary. They took hostages and demanded negotiations with the state. But state police moved in to retake the prison by force at the order of the governor. Scores were killed or wounded, and allegations of a cover-up soon followed. That riot may have been ground zero in the efforts to recognize prisoners' rights, and the incident is documented in the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971, and its legacy, a finalist for the National Book Award. The author, Dr. Heather Ann Thompson, is professor of history in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. She was formerly a professor of history at UNC Charlotte. She'll be in Charlotte on Wednesday at the Harvey B. Gantt Center to sign her book at 10:30 and at UNC Charlotte Center City at 6:30 to speak. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. And Dr. Thompson joins us for the hour. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Your book is an extensive dive into the Attica prison uprising, what led to it, and its aftermath as well. So why did you feel it was important 45 years after the fact to look back at this event in such an extensive way?
Well, Attica stands out as one of the most interesting civil rights protests of the 20th century, and yet we knew so little about it. Really interesting because it was a civil rights protest that took place in a prison behind bars, and also notorious because it ended in terrible bloodshed. And something happened in the next 40 years right after Attica, which is this massive, massive prison buildup. So it seemed like there was a lot to unpack about Attica. And I decided to do a book on it, having really no idea that the reason nothing had been written was that the state of New York was really hoping that the story would not be told and, in effect, has really shut down all the records related to it. So that really just piqued my interest, I think, all the more.
You used the term civil rights, and I read that yesterday, that this has been called one of the nation's most important civil rights stories and protest. I had never really thought about it in those terms. How has this been overlooked as being on par with other civil rights struggles?
Well, I think most Americans would imagine that when prisoners rise up behind bars, that that it is just as the word connotes, a riot, something that is incoherent, just violent, a bunch of bored prisoners who are criminally minded by nature anyway, who just decide to wreak havoc inside of their facility. In fact, throughout American history, all the way back, when prisoners have stood together and initiated some form of protest, it is always because the conditions inside are horrendous. And it's always been a real effort to speak out for really human rights, but also civil rights, because racial discrimination runs rampant in prisons just as it does in the broader society. And because this was 1971, the lines between the protests inside and outside of prisons were quite thin. Some of the people that were in the prisons had already been activists outside of prisons.
Hmm. I was going to ask you if the inmates who did rise up, or some of them, back in 71, took their cue from civil rights struggles happening outside the prison. So you're saying yes, because many of them had experience with those struggles.
Well, to be sure, there is a presence of folks inside of all American prisons in the 70s, and Attica is no exception, that were many of them were there, in fact, for having been protesters on the outside. But many of them were there because they had really experienced that intense policing, that hyper-policing of particularly black and brown neighborhoods in America's cities. They were there because they had experienced that racial profiling in America's cities that was just so characteristic of that period. So while some of them were intensely political, that is to say, were reading, for example, Malcolm X or about King, many of them just came to this logically, just as folks did outside of prison walls. They were well aware that they were people who were not being treated as human beings. And just because they were behind bars, it didn't mean that they had checked their humanity at the door when they began serving their sentence.
Would you say this is the moment when I think you used the word origin story. Is this the origin story of what we're going through today with mass incarceration and police violence and the Black Lives Matter movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting – it's a critically important moment in that story. On the one hand, we had already begun a pretty intensive, really historically unprecedented war on crime before Attica. It actually started in 1965, and that was very much in response to civil rights unrest in Philadelphia and Rochester and Harlem and, of course, across the South. But Attica is critical because the response to it on the part of the state really had a devastating impact on the nation's feeling about whether prisoner rights and prisons themselves were worthy of attention, were in need of humane conditions. So when you get into the Attica story, you begin to understand why it is that for the next 40 years, people turn their back on prisons. And it was the turning the back on prisons that allowed the conditions to worsen, allowed them to become so crowded, and really allowed us to become the world's largest jailer, you know, with North Carolina by 2011 having, you know, more than 52,000 people behind bars and almost 56,000 under some form of correctional control. We can't understand that unless we understand why people abandon prisoner rights after 1971.
You took 13 years to write this book. That's a long time. And as I say, it's very extensive and it's a very big book. And you've unpacked a lot of information and drawn lines through history with regard to what happened. It's not just about the uprising there. It goes on from there. It was most of that time, that 13 years spent in research, getting access to research materials, checking sources, writing, rewriting. Why did it take 13 years to compile all of this?
Well, I can tell you that was certainly not planned. The book was supposed to be done probably within about 2 or 3 years. But mm-hmm. when I began the project, I mean, historians are quite used to when they begin a project, they go into archives and they start looking at documents and records and piecing together the story. The problem with this story was that every time I tried to get the records from the state of New York, they were not available to me. Literally, I would file Freedom of Information requests that were either denied or they would come back to me so redacted. It was very difficult to read them. And I quickly figured out that most of the state's records, which were voluminous, I mean thousands and thousands of boxes, literally could not be accessed. Some were legally sealed. Some were just put away in places that no one was going to get for you. So the journey of writing the book was really the research journey. It was trying to figure out who had the copy of whatever the state of New York had or who had the original. And frankly, trying to figure out what was at stake. Why was it that this public prison run by public officials, elected officials, was what had happened there that was so dire, so bad that even 40 years later, people didn't want you to tell about it. So that was really the research journey.
We're going to talk about that. But is it unusual? Because I'm sure as an historian, you do a lot of research. Is it unusual for records to be so disjointed and hidden away or seemingly deliberately in some cases so that access is difficult, if not impossible? Is that the normal course of events after 45 years that records would be so difficult to get to?
Well, it's interesting. It depends on what the topic is. I think for historians that work on the more recent and more radical period of the 1960s and 1970s, this is actually quite common. Many of these people who were involved at Attica are still alive. Many of the issues that were brought up at Attica are still very much alive. So the closer you are, not necessarily chronologically, but certainly in terms of topic or issue, it is difficult to do this kind of research. And so part of it for me was trying to figure out how to reimagine being a historian. And frankly, it meant being a bit more of a journalist than I think historians often are asked to do.
I remember this incident vaguely, but I do remember what I felt and what people talked about with regard to this incident. It was a time when we were still shocked by things like this. I'm not sure that we would be shocked in the same way today. But take us back to September 1971, to Attica State Prison in New York. How did this uprising start and how did it unfold?
Well, so Attica was a prison in upstate New York, as you mentioned, in a really tiny town. Most American prisons are in these small towns away from center cities, and it was no different here. It was really crammed with 2,400 men who had mostly come from downstate, from places like New York City and the Bronx and so forth.
And it should be pointed out that Attica is actually closer to Detroit than it is to Manhattan.
It is. It's way upstate. And frankly, again, this is very typical. It's typical in the South as well, that prisons are very far removed from the cities that feed them. And in this case, Attica was filled with overwhelmingly minority prisoners, although there were a lot of white prisoners there. These are prisoners who were there often for the same reasons they're there today, drug addiction, crimes related to drug addiction, like burglary. Some of them were returning vets from the Vietnam War. And many of them really all of them were quite poor, had not had good lawyers to start with, and were serving quite lengthy sentences in a facility that was built during the Depression. It was really a barbaric facility. The conditions were horrendous. They had, one square of toilet paper a day, a tiny bar of soap to last a month, a shower a week, really poor, is being fed on 63 cents a day, so people were hungry. And into this mix was a lot of people who understood that this was not probably legal and certainly not just. So they began writing letters and trying to get things fixed through the system, trying to appeal to administrators' better nature. And ultimately, this really fails. They get no help, indeed get more repression, more cell sweeps, more time in solitary. And on September 9th, 1971, actually a series of quite accidental things lead to complete chaos. And that is what's going to touch off the Attica uprising of 1971.
We only have about a minute left here but in this segment. But did the prisoners plan a riot, or did they simply plan to be more demonstrative in making their demands, to simply hold a protest? I know they took hostages. Was that part of the plan?
Well, there was no plan. In fact, the state of New York would for years afterwards try to show conspiracy. But what happened was the administration essentially retaliated against some prisoners. They locked them in a hall. And because a gate came down that really was structurally flawed, all of a sudden everybody was fearful, running around, taking hostages, not quite sure what was going to happen next. It was indeed a riot in those first few moments. Mm-hmm. But what was remarkable was within a very short period of time, they all moved to one place in D Yard, 1,300 men, and began a coherent, rational civil rights protest.
And we'll talk about what happened next in a moment and the aftermath of all this and what it means to the 21st century of the United States of America and how we deal with incarcerated persons. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina's healthcare systems, HealthWorks, working with employers to improve the bottom line through innovative employee health solutions. Carolinashealthcare.org/health. HealthWorks, and TRCW, a specialty shop for women built and headquartered in Charlotte in Phillips Place, featuring American and European clothing and accessories for women of discriminating taste. Details at trcstyle.com. Well, it's been 3 weeks since the polls closed, and we still don't have the results in the governor's race in North Carolina. The road to that determination has been a meandering one. Pat McCrory is questioning the validity of the election and is challenging some votes in a race his opponent continues to lead by about 7,700 votes. So we get an update on that, and then we're headed for an update on education as a result of the election and the ongoing superintendent search here. That's all tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, lawmakers are making a final push on issues like spending and mental health care, what Congress can get done in its lame duck session, and President Obama's efforts to protect his legacy.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to Dr. Heather Ann Thompson, professor of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. She's coming to town on Wednesday to sign books at the Harvey B. Gantt Center and to speak at UNC Charlotte Center City at 6:30 that evening. She's the author of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its Legacy. And we've been talking about the uprising. We'll talk about the legacy a little bit later on. Before we continue with the story of what happened on that day, in September the 9th of 1971, talk to me about why conditions were so bad, why they were only allowed one shower a week, why only a single roll of toilet paper a month, which equated to about a sheet per day. Why only 63 cents being spent per day on each prisoner for food? Why?
Well, the why is hard to really really hard to explain. Other than prisons are public institutions that are completely removed from the general population, and people know so little about what goes on behind bars and just imagines the worst and imagines the people in them to be the worst. And so therefore, there's little pressure to run these institutions humanely, even though virtually everyone in them will come home. Everyone in them is someone's mother, father, brother, sister, child. And so the answer is really difficult to come up with other than just really the punitive answer. And of course, as always with public institutions, lack of funding and lack of desire to make them more humane.
Hmm. So the prisoners decided they'd had enough. They protested. Chaos quickly ensued. But then they took it out into a central area and actually began to cohesively make their demands. But they did have hostages. The hostages were what, prison guards?
Right. They were prison guards as well as civilian employees in the prison. And the men inside took hostages with the idea that the state of New York would not talk to them, would not negotiate with them unless they had hostages. That decision is going to be one of the reasons why this story is so important, because, of course, ultimately the state of New York will find those hostages as dispensable as the prisoners. But before then, these guys elect representatives out of each of the cell blocks to speak for them. They surround the hostages with two rings of prisoners to make sure that they're protected, make sure they have mattresses, food, and they bring in a roster of really important observers to oversee these negotiations that go on for 4 days. The list of demands are basic human rights demands, and actually really it's remarkable because they bring in the media. And so the entire world is soon watching this thing unfold.
How did they accomplish all that? How did the prisoners bring in the media?
They basically, this was one of their first demands, that they had the media inside, because they understood that with no one watching, any number of atrocities might happen. So they wanted the media there. They wanted reporters inside. They wanted television cameras rolling. And they wanted everyone to see what they were asking for and to see that they were treating the hostages humanely.
What were they asking for?
Everything from more food to better access to their family through visitation to, for example, an improvement of parole rules. The old parole rules were that if you got a parole, you had to go through an old, outdated phone book and write to employers in the hope that they would hire you, and you couldn't get out until they did. They wanted the superintendent to be replaced in their prison because he was quite insensitive. They wanted better medical care. People were actually dying in that prison because of the poor medical care. And they actually wanted just a better situation for everybody because they understood that even the guards were having a tough time, that things were so brutal inside.
They also wanted less male censorship. And I read that for the Hispanic prisoners, the mail was in Spanish. So the guards, not being able to censor it, simply tossed the letters, threw them away.
Exactly.
Why were they censoring the mail?
Well, they were, of course, as always, terrified that they would be somehow educating prisoners and that educated prisoners were smarter prisoners who understood their rights better. Mm. And so much like, you know, way back in the day with slavery, one of the ways you control people is to make sure that they can't read or make sure that they don't read. And in this case, censorship was a huge, huge issue. When the rebellion actually begins, notably, the prisoners make sure that everything that gets set up at the negotiation table is translated into Spanish so that the Puerto Rican prisoners could understand as well as everybody else what was at stake and what was happening. Hmm.
Did the state at any time agree or even recognize any of these demands as being legitimate?
They do. And one of the most remarkable things about this protest is that thanks to the prisoners' negotiating skills, the observers' determination to see this to a peaceful end, and indeed the state really in a way being over a barrel and being forced to negotiate, the state ultimately agrees to 28 of the 32 demands. The problem was what they wouldn't agree to was amnesty. That is, the prisoners' desire that if they surrendered, they would not be made to pay a price for the rebellion itself, either legally or what they were really most afraid of was physically, the physical reprisals that might happen should they surrender. And the state would not agree to amnesty.
So the state police, at the order of the governor, Nelson Rockefeller at the time, went into the prison to take it back. What triggered that event? Because negotiations were still going on, were they not?
They were. And one of the things that my book really was just absolutely clear about was that the state was planning on going in all along. It's been a myth for 40 years that they were negotiating in good faith. They were determined to go in with force. They had amassed almost 1,000 state troopers from all over New York outside of the prison. They were passing out weapons indiscriminately, not writing down serial numbers, not following procedure. And those were the men that the governor would decide on the fifth day to send in without giving the prisoners an ultimatum, without indicating what was about ready to happen.
Further, you say that the state troopers removed all of their identifying badges. Some of them took their own personal weapons and ammunition that was designed to do damage, not just subdue people, but actually do damage inside the body.
That's right.
Who made that decision? Was that an order from the top down, the governor down, or made that decision?
It is unclear why people would have it's not clear that someone was instructed other than at the battalion level to take off their identifying badges, which they absolutely were. That didn't come from on high. But what did come from on high was the absolute recognition that these guys had been out there for 4 days. They were furious. They were not trained in riot control. They had been fed on a rumor of inmate atrocities coming from the FBI. These were not the men to send in. And in fact, the observers, the officials told Governor Rockefeller, if you send these men in, it's going to be a massacre. And indeed, it was. And in no small part, because before he sent them in, he first sent in a helicopter that dumped the CNCS gas over the prison, which essentially incapacitated the men. It was in their nasal passages. They were retching. They were blinded. That's when the state troopers, and incidentally, quite a few corrections officers as well, went in with guns blazing.
They shot scores of unarmed men, severely wounded more than 100 others. They knew that prison guards being held hostage would be killed. Were these hostages considered by authorities at the time to be necessary casualties? Why was no one ever held accountable for this?
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to understand in my book. I wanted to understand how it was that the prisoners had more faith that the government, in this case the state government, would protect its own than clearly the government was due. They did see these hostages as dispensable. Clearly, they knew. One of the things I found out was that they knew that they were going to kill the hostages when they went in. For 40 years, they denied that. They said that there was collateral damage. But they knew that, and they were informed. If you go in like this, hostages are going to die.
But the media was inside.
Well, not at this point. The media at this point has been told to leave. And indeed, this is where it gets really interesting, because after going in, after killing both hostages and prisoners, after wounding 128 people so severely, some of them six, seven bullet wounds, that's when the state steps out in front of the prison and tells the world via the media. By the way, this goes out on the AP. Every small town newspaper reads that the prisoners have actually killed all the hostages. And that worse, they've castrated one of them. They've committed atrocities. And that's not what happened. But that story is going to sour a nation on prisoners and prison reform for
a
generation.
Well, that's what I remember. As the news unfolded back in 1971, whatever sympathy people had for prisoners' rights evaporated instantly because of all these stories about inmates killing their hostages and the horrible atrocities that were...
That's right.
But every single thing, you say, that we have been told about what happened on that day is an utter lie. That is those are your words, utter lie.
That's absolutely correct.
That everyone killed in that riot was killed by law enforcement, and you assert that Attica's long history makes it crystal clear that when police officers are not held accountable for shooting unarmed black citizens, one cannot assume that this indicates either that they weren't guilty or that there was insufficient evidence to prosecute them. That's a leap from Attica to what's happening today.
That's right.
So how do you make that leap?
Well, here's what listeners need to understand. On the day of the retaking, law enforcement is responsible for every death on the day of the retaking. And yet, for the next 40 years, not one member of law enforcement is ever held accountable. Instead, the state goes after the prisoners, indicts 62 of them. The cases are so shoddy that they fall apart. But nevertheless, the nation has sent this message that everything that went wrong at Attica was down to the prisoners, not law enforcement. Well, it turns out, and my research finally was able to shine some light on this, it turns out that that's not because the state didn't have evidence against law enforcement. Indeed, there was a concerted effort from the highest levels of government. By the way, this goes all the way up to the Nixon administration to protect law enforcement. They knew who had shot people. They knew exactly who had committed these atrocities, and not one of them were prosecuted. Actually, evidence was destroyed. They actually allowed the same state police that retook the prison to conduct the investigation into the retaking. So the majority of my book actually uncovers this cover-up, and it leaves the reader, and I hope the listener, a little bit thinking about the present day, because we do assume when someone's not prosecuted that that means there was no evidence. Clearly, Attica shows that that's not always the case.
Yeah. You mentioned that it went all the way to the White House. And somewhere I read yesterday in some article, and I forgot which one it was, that whatever you thought negatively about Richard Nixon, it wasn't enough.
Yes. He had one question after Attica. You have to bear in mind, this is literally – the title of my book is Blood in the Water, because that's all you could see that day of the retaking. And Nixon had one question for Rockefeller, and that was basically this: is it a black business? And when Rockefeller said, yes, indeed, Mr. President, it is, which, of course, it was not. It was multiracial. That's all Nixon needs to know. In other words, it is absolutely fine to go in and shoot unarmed men as long as this is about putting down a civil rights struggle. And Nixon was clear on this.
But Nelson Rockefeller is dead. Richard Nixon is dead. Why is the cover-up still going on? Why did it take you, an historian, not a journalist, not a prosecutor, to uncover all of this?
Well, I'm asked that a lot. And to be honest, it's a difficult question to answer because on the one hand, it's completely illogical. Again, these are public institutions. We should have access to all of the Attica records. The survivors, hostages and prisoners alike, want access. Both were treated terribly. And we can't have it. So why? Well, the obvious answer is that there's no statute of limitations on murder. State police killed and corrections officers killed people in that prison. And without justification. I actually think that there would not be prosecutions today, but I think that that fear is what leads the state police time and again to block access to the records. And then at the governmental level, there's always the sense that if you admit wrongdoing, that somehow it's a slippery slope. So even today, the governor's office is loath to talk about Attica. To this day, nobody has admitted responsibility at the state level.
In an article that you wrote for NBC, you say that what Attica and the ensuing cover revealed is unlikely to be exceptional. In other words, what happened there is kind of the norm. And you've also insisted that police in this country have been protected and therefore inquiries into shootings cannot be conducted or should not be conducted by police or by prosecutors, and that all these cases have to be open to the public. So then who then should investigate?
Well, it's just clear that if you do have a conflict between law enforcement and the citizenry, there has to be an independent body, preferably a citizen body, disconnected from the prosecutor's office and disconnected from law enforcement that conducts the investigation. And the reasons for that are very, very clear. Prosecutors rely on police all the time. They have to make their cases, as they should. But this is just one incident where there's just way too many interests in common to be objective. We know that the grand jury process and the prosecutorial process relies on law enforcement as allies. And so if there's a moment when law enforcement has committed a crime, it is very difficult for those inquiries to be objective.
And this leads to what we're dealing with right now in this rash of incidents that we've had reported because of cell phone video of shootings of African-American men, particularly by police around the country, and the lack of transparency in many of those investigations. We still don't have that kind of transparency.
That's right. And there's another parallel, which is that even today, I'm leaving aside whether or not a member of law enforcement actually is indicted or ever serves time for killing a citizen when it wasn't justified. It is interesting that in all of the times when there's footage, even if the person has a gun, the citizen has a gun, the assumption is that that is sufficient reason to have killed them, when, of course, that isn't sufficient. There is this sense in which there has to be danger. There has to be some justification for shooting, even if there is a gun on the premises. So this question of evidence is really interesting. And what Attica shows is that when there's blatant evidence, as there was at Attica, in this case, the state police got together with the governor, got together with the attorney general, and sat down in their pool house and got their story straight. And the state police removed photographs. The state police spliced film. So it really just makes you understand if there's clear evidence, we need to have clear chain of command as to what happened to it. And if there is shaky evidence, we have to be really clear what the law is as to what would be a justified shooting.
Did conditions at Attica or other prisons around the country at the time change or improve as a result of this riot, this incident?
Well, this is one of the greatest tragedies. This is an extraordinary human rights rebellion to bring about greater prisoner rights. But because of the lies told about why Attica was so brutal and bloody, as you say, the nation sours on prisoner rights for the next 40 years. And one of the reasons why I'm glad to come to North Carolina and other places around the country to talk about this is that I think this is a moment where we can assess today's prisons. Today's prisons are actually worse than they were in 1971.
And let me stop you there, Dr. Heather Ann Thompson. Our guests will come back in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Waldron Law Firm, immigration law for families, proudly serving the LGBT community, green cards, and more, 704-444-0057 or waldronlawfirm.com. And Donald Hack Diamonds, helping you celebrate with a holiday open house Thursday, December 1st through Saturday, December 3rd in the Moorcroft Village, South Park. Details at donaldhack.com. Fidel Castro died on Friday at the age of 90, one of the world's longest-serving heads of state. He began to fade from the public eye in 2006, but he is still both beloved and deeply loathed by generations of Cubans. His death has set off celebrations and mourning in his country and around the world as Cuba begins to look at how to move forward without one of the world's most revolutionary and polarizing figures. Diane Rehm and her guests take a look at the personal and political life of Fidel Castro and what's next for Cuba, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Let's conclude a train ride through Pakistan. NPR's Philip Reeves has spent many years covering that massive country.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
It's the city's biggest project since the 1990s, when development began at Ballantyne in South Charlotte.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Heather Ann Thompson is with us, professor of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan, formerly with UNC Charlotte. She's the author of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its Legacy. We're talking about prison conditions not really improving after Attica because of the fact that it was presented in the media, thanks to the government, as being a massacre by prisoners of prisoners and hostages. And so the public sentiment kind of soured on that. And you say that today's prisons are worse.
Right. We had an opportunity in 1971 to finally make prisons humane institutions. And rather than do that, we got the story wrong and we set about building really the world's largest prison nation. Today, throughout the North and the South, prisons are horrendous. And just like they were in 71, they're filled with a lot of people who, in fact, need drug treatment, in fact, need mental health care. And even for those whom society would deem the worst of the worst, they are people. And we have an opportunity, I think, today to use Attica to rethink the way we handle our justice system.
You wrote an article for The Atlantic in which you said today's rates of incarceration in America's poorest, blackest, and brownest neighborhoods are historically unprecedented. By 2001, one in six black men had been incarcerated, and by the close of 2013, black and Latino inmates comprised almost 60%. Of the nation's federal and state prison population, the numbers of incarcerated black women are also stark. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, young black women ages 18 to 19 were almost five times more likely to be imprisoned than white women of the same age in 2010. And you date some of this back, these policies and procedures, I guess is a good word to use, to Lyndon Johnson and passing of the Law Enforcement Assistance Act of 1965. Now, Lyndon Johnson is thought widely to be the guy who brought civil rights legislation forefront. But in 1965, he also signed his name to the Law Enforcement Assistance Act. And this led to, well, this was a reaction, you say, to the civil rights movement. They saw this not as democracy in action, but as criminal elements that would only grow more dangerous if not checked.
Well, one way to think about it is that the Johnson administration and, in fact, many Northerners were all about the civil rights movement as long as it was south of the Mason-Dixon line. They were all about going down and enforcing civil rights laws. The problem was when it started to come to Philadelphia and Detroit and Harlem, all of a sudden they start sounding a lot more like Sheriff Bull Connor, that this is not really legitimate, that these are thugs, not civil rights activists, and we begin a war on crime.
And we get echoes of that in the Nixon administration.
Exactly.
The silent majority and the war on crime we're seeing it today, crackdown on crime.
Well, that's why history is so important, because the statistics that you just read about how many more black and brown people are incarcerated than white lead so many Americans to think, well, okay, that's unfortunate, but that's who's doing the crime, and so therefore it is what it is. But if you look at the historical record, you quickly understand that's not why it is what it is. Only certain communities are hyper-policed. We actually know that more white people sell drugs, more white people use drugs than black people. But that's not reflected in our criminal justice system. So this is a question about rethinking policing, rethinking resources, rethinking our justice system. And the only way to do that is to understand how we got here, rather than to look at the statistics today and make erroneous assumptions about why they look the way they do.
Were you a journalist, this investigation might have stopped with Attica itself, maybe gone back to 1965 and the act that I just referenced. But you're an historian. So you go back 100 more years.
Right, right.
To the 1870s. The ratification of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, one of Congress's first efforts to broaden the franchise, the voting franchise after the Civil War. They were worried about a power grab on the part of ex-Confederates. Talk about that.
Well, so it's interesting that the 14th Amendment is meant to expand voting rights for black citizens, but what ultimately ends up happening is it's used to disfranchise anyone who is a prisoner. It's used to justify felon disfranchisement. And the reason I bring that up, I don't talk very much about 100 years ago in the book, but I do point out that there's been another moment in American history when we did this mass incarceration, and it was right after the Civil War. That wasn't because black folks started committing crimes in record numbers and white folks stopped committing crimes. It's that we actually changed where we began policing. We began locking up black folks for things we hadn't before. And so prisons across the South became all black overnight. And this was really in response to emancipation. The 14th Amendment helped to disfranchise them, which, of course, is a big issue if you're going to all of a sudden have black voting in the South. And so we put people to work. We took away their right to vote, and we began locking up black folks in record numbers. We do the same thing after 1965. We begin intense policing in black neighborhoods. We take away blacks' right to vote. So ironically, Lyndon Johnson passes the Voting Rights Act of 65, but because he also begins the war on crime, one eventually will undermine the other.
Let me see if I understand this, because I want to be clear on the 14th Amendment here, because it stipulated that any state that denied the right to vote to any male inhabitant of the state over 21 would have its representation in Congress downsized, correct?
Yes.
But Southerners didn't like the idea of black citizens voting, and so if they put them in jail, then it was legal not to let them vote.
Right. So the most interesting amendment is actually the 13th Amendment, because it says that you can continue slavery in one instance and one instance only, and that is if someone's been convicted of a crime. Mm-hmm. Where the 14th Amendment comes in is that meanwhile, once they were incarcerated, states tried to take away their right to vote. And when this was tested, ultimately decided in the 1970s in a case versus Richardson versus Ramirez, it was decided that particular section of the 14th Amendment that was actually meant to protect black voting against whites who were in violation, whites who were in uproar against the Constitution, ends up being used, applied to people behind bars, people with a criminal record who are by then disproportionately black. So it's very complicated. Mm-hmm. But the upshot of it is using the Constitution to take away the human rights of people behind bars, which could be black or white, but because of racialized policing is disproportionately black and brown.
That was certainly racialized in the 1870s. I'm sure there was racial motivation. Do you think we are consciously racially motivated today? Is that why we have more black and brown and Hispanic prisoners today, because of that? Or is it simply in our psyche that these people are dangerous because they commit more crime?
I think it's both. I think that there is what they would call this implicit bias, and people look at the statistics and they say, oh, Prisons are filled with these people, so these people must be more inherently criminal. But the fact is that that is a bit of an excuse. We do know that the active, virulent racism is very much alive today. I get the hate mail that I get indicates this very, very clearly. It's not hidden. It's not cloaked. It is brutally racist. And so I think it's a mix. I think that we have to be very, very conscious of it, though, both what is explicit and implicit.
Some of this racism is certainly emerging today in the aftermath of the election. But most of the police shootings that have been in the media so much occurred well before the election. And so people who do not live in the black community expressed great surprise over this rash. It seemed like every day there was a new report of a new shooting, and it was captured on cell phone video. So we were surprised by all of this, while people in the African-American community were not surprised by all of this. If we were surprised by that, and this is all part of a continuum from 1870 onward through Attica and beyond, what does that say about us?
Well, I think what it says, and I think it's important that we don't flatten everything from 1870 forward, but just rather to notice the ways in which there's this haunting racism that if we don't finally address and finally acknowledge and do our best to mitigate it against it in our criminal justice system, we inadvertently or advertently perpetuate these really terrible situations, including police shootings. We know that police officers don't have to individually be racist to assume that a black man with a gun is more threatening than a white man with a gun. We know this. We know the studies. So what we have to do is figure out a way to think about rooting out that racism to the best we can in our criminal justice system. No white person who is honest denies, speaking as a white person, there's no white person who's honest who does not know that racism, in fact, is deep in the white community. Whether or not it's explicit or implicit, every white person knows that it's real and that it shapes our criminal justice system. And it's the reason why white folks feel safer and don't worry about their children being pulled over and shot, because they know that they are protected by being white in that sense.
Conditions at Attica were not good. They were miserable, in fact, for the individuals there. Human rights were being violated at least through contemporary 21st century eyes. They were being violated. And yet conditions seem to have worsened in prisons today. In many cases, you say, you call them a disgrace. What are conditions in U.S. prisons today?
We have people serving extraordinary amounts of time in solitary confinement today, even though everybody, every medical professional, every human rights organization knows that this is torture. We have people being fed maggot-filled food. We have people being forced into strip cells naked for extended periods of time. We have physical abuse. Right now, the Justice Department is investigating the physical abuse of prisoners across the country. So we really are in a terrible situation. And why do we not know more about it? Because we can't get inside. Again, public institutions that we pay for, but a state senator cannot just show up at the door and say, let me in
right now. Why not?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I don't know, because they just say no. And then someone has to file an injunction. Someone has to file paperwork. So part of this story is about transparency. We need to know what goes on behind those bars, because we know that all of those people are, again, they are returning citizens. They are people who will be our neighbors. They will be people in our communities. And frankly, if we're all honest, we know people who are drug addicted, people who have broken the law. And so once we realize that, we know that everyone who's behind bars is us. We just have to figure out how to deal with it.
Is that why most white collar and political criminals end up in country club prisons, so that they cannot come back when they get out and report the miserable conditions, or because they're being protected because they're somehow better than the other prisoners?
Well, both. And frankly, it's because we understand that those people are going to come back and be our neighbors. And we know that if you put someone in solitary confinement, or if you abuse them and beat them and starve them, that they will come home a lesser person. They will come home damaged. And because we know that, we have an obligation to make sure that everyone – look, when you're serving time, you don't You did not get sentenced to abuse or torture or neglect. You just simply got served time. Mm-hmm. And we have to be aware of that.
Just recently, the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer reported on the use of solitary confinement here in prisons in North Carolina, saying that state prison officials are moving away now from the broad use of solitary confinement and have cut in half the number of inmates kept in isolation. Last spring, about 5,300 of the state's 38,000 prisoners, 1 in 7, were in solitary, and now that number's been cut in half. And they now say that solitary confinement doesn't help and exacerbates problems with mentally ill inmates. Now they want to focus on education and work programs. Are we late to the party on this, or are we leading the way?
Well, I think North Carolina, if it continues on this trend, is doing the right thing. Frankly, guards inside of prisons, COs inside of prisons, know that this is making their lives harder to have abusive prisons. So I think that North Carolina is trying to do the right thing, but we're going to see. We were at a juncture of real possibility before this election. We had bipartisan support for criminal justice reform, but our president-elect has now started using the terms law and order again. So we will see. I can tell you that I've spoken to many corrections officers, and they want more humane prisons too. They understand that this is a terrible way to run these institutions. So I hope that we listen to the people on the ground in this new presidential moment. I hope we continue that beating back of solitary and elimination of terribly long sentences.
From an historian's point of view, had we learned something from Attica in 1971, and had we taken a cold, hard look, a transparent look at how we operate prisons and how we treat prisoners, and how we decide who should be in prison and who should not be in prison, what would we be like today if we had taken that look?
We would be much closer to most other Western democracies on the planet. We would have much more restorative justice programs, much more education for people before they ever end up in the criminal justice system. We would have better health care so people were not drug addicted and committing crimes as addicts. There are so many models we have that do not require us looking to a socialist or communist country. There's so many Western democracies that we can look at for our models. And had we paid attention in 71, we might have avoided really what has become generational devastation of mass incarceration. One only needs to go to our nation's poorest communities and see these entire blocks emptied out to our prisons to understand we've made a terrible mistake, and we are going to spend – it's going to take generations, frankly, to undo the damage, to remedy it.
And why do you suppose we are this way? Is it simply racial, or is it fear? Is it ignorance? And I only have 10 seconds.
It's all of it, but mostly we just need to treat everyone as we would treat our own children, and I think we're good.
Dr. Heather Ann Thompson, author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971, and Its Legacy. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you so much.